describe as populist. Populism originally arose in the decades after the Civil War as an agrarian movement of farmers victimized by the Industrial Revolution then sweeping the United States. Now, while that revolution had created enormous wealth for some, as well as for the nation as a whole, it also impoverished many others, most notably unskilled factory workers and farmers. Now, today, some know about the workers' plight, but far fewer know about the farmers' plight, perhaps because such a small percentage of our population is today engaged in farming. But that was not the case in the last quarter of the 19th century. And the problems those millions of farmers faced were quite serious. The basic problem was overproduction, due primarily to the mechanization of agriculture and a massive expansion of acreage under cultivation. Between 1860 and 1910, the number of farms in the country tripled. Simultaneously, the quantity of crops one could grow and harvest expanded enormously as the Industrial Revolution hit agriculture. For example, the number of acres one could harvest in a day increased from 2 using a hand scythe to 12 using a McCormick reaper. Now, by the laws of supply and demand, the result of this enormous expansion of supply was falling prices with each bumper crop. Between 1881 and 1894, wheat fell from $1.19 a bushel to 49 cents a bushel, and corn from 63 cents to 18 cents. This problem was compounded by overseas competition. The American farmer was now part of a world market, and the agricultural revolution was worldwide. The farmer's economic problems were further worsened by a host of additional factors. First, the general deflation of the time, combined with the fact that the farmer is perennially in debt due to his need to buy land, seed, equipment, and now large-scale machinery as well. Deflation makes it much more difficult to pay off his ensuing debts. A 50% drop in the price that the farmer receives for his produce means he has to grow twice as much to pay off the original debt. But the more he grows, the lower the price goes, and what you get is a vicious cycle. Now, secondly, high tariffs raise the price of manufactured goods that the farmer has to buy, but not the price of his produce. In effect, he is forced to sell on a world market of depressed agricultural prices, but buy manufactured goods on a protected market of high prices. He also faces very high taxes on his property. All of his property is very visible. And he faces very high interest rates from banks, loan companies, and insurance companies. Farmers also face very high railroad rates to ship produce to market. By the laws of supply and demand, the railroads are charging farmers more in the West and South, where there is a lack of competing railroad lines, than they are in the East, where there are plenty of competing lines. In addition to that, the farmer is often charged more for a short haul than a long haul. Indeed, it often costs the farmer more to ship a bushel of wheat than that bushel of wheat is worth. The railroads also control land and land sales due to the government land grants that we discussed in a previous lecture. The railroads also control the grain elevators and storage area costs and middleman fees. Now, in the South, all of these problems are compounded by tenant farming, sharecropping, and the crop lien system. Many Southern farmers, white as well as black, do not own their own land. Instead, they live and work on someone else's land as tenants. And they pay the owner, i.e. the landlord, with a percentage of their annual crop. They also pledge a percentage of their crop in order to be able to purchase tools, seeds, and daily necessities. This is all taking place as their crops are worth less and less, and that just drives them further into debt. The farmers' problems are also a result of the shift from self-sufficiency to specialized commercial farming, which places him at the mercy of market forces beyond his control. And farmers face social isolation and a loss of social status in this new industrialized and urbanized America. In Thomas Jefferson's time, Jefferson had described farmers as God's chosen people. By this time period, farmers are referred to by such insulting terms as hayseed or hick. The existing political parties are incapable or unwilling to help the farmers, essentially for two reasons. What one historian, Eric Goldman, labeled the steel chain of ideas. Combine Adam Smith's laissez-faire ideology and laws of supply and demand with David Ricardo's iron law of wages, which holds that labor's wages will always go to the subsistence level. You combine both of these with other economic beliefs, and you reach the conclusion that nothing can be done politically to change things. That these are laws. These are economic laws. Andrew Carnegie would comment that economic inequality in the industrial era was inevitable and that it was useless to criticize what was inevitable. That's the first factor, but there is a second one, a political one. The two parties are so evenly matched at this time that elections will hinge on only 6 states and a very small number of voters. Now, one would think that that would lead to discussion of the real issues, but the very opposite happens. Given how close the elections are, there is an extraordinary emphasis on political machines in the cities, corporate contributions, and special favors to swing key states. From the farmers' point of view, both parties are thus corrupt, and there is no real difference between them. Now, as a result of all of this, the farmers begin to organize. At first, locally, with what began as a social organization, the Patrons of Husbandry, or Grange, in 1867. The Grange then became political. And you had in many states in the Midwest in the late 1870s, so-called Granger laws passed to regulate the railroads. Now, at first, the Supreme Court had allowed such laws, specifically in the 1877 decision of Munn versus Illinois. But by 1886, in the Wabash cases, the court had shifted. It ruled that the state Granger laws were unconstitutional, that the railroads were interstate commerce, and thus they were a federal issue rather than a state issue. And, of course, the federal government was not doing anything. That led to the formation of the farmers' alliances to elect national as well as state officials. There were 3 alliances, 1 in the Midwest and 2 in the South, 1 white and 1 black, with over 5 million members. In the election of 1890, they were very successful. They elected 6 governors, 3 senators, and 50 congressmen. In 1892, the alliances met and created the People's Party, or Populist Party, in Omaha. The party attempted to unite all farmers, all industrial workers, and all reformers. But it would be dominated by the 3 farmers' alliances. The Populist Party's platform began with apocalyptic language. We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The fruits of the toil of millions, it boldly asserted after giving examples of this moral, political, and material ruin, are boldly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few unprecedented in the history of mankind, and the possessors of these in turn despise the republic and endanger liberty. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice, we breed the 2 great classes, tramps and millionaires. What then followed was, as one historian has aptly stated, one of the most comprehensive reform documents in American history. The populist platform called for government ownership of the railroads, the telegraph lines, and the telephone. It also called for an end to government subsidies to private corporations. It maintained that unused land held by the railroads and other corporations, as well as aliens, was to be expropriated and held for, quote, actual settlers. It called for a graduated income tax. It called for political reforms to give power back to the people. That included the initiative, where legislation could begin by petitions signed by a large number of people rather than simply the state legislature. The referendum, whereby the people as a whole, rather than the legislative body, would vote on a bill, and the recall, where an elected official could be recalled before the end of the term of office. The platform also called for direct election of senators instead of through the state legislatures and one term for the president. Nor was that the end of it. It called for an end to government subsidies for corporations and the abolition of the corporate private army, such as the Pinkerton detectives. It called for a sub-treasury plan for the storage of grain by the government and the ability of farmers to borrow on that grain. It expressed sympathy for labor unions trying to shorten hours and called for rigid enforcement of the 8-hour day for government workers and limited immigration instead of unlimited immigration. But the plank which became the key one was the free and unlimited coinage of silver as well as gold at a ratio of 16 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. Now that requires some explanation. The government had printed money as it received gold or silver, but in 1873, it agreed to accept only gold. The populists would label this the crime of 73 and would call for the acceptance of silver again at a higher rate than in the open market so that people who had silver would bring it to the government and the government would then create more paper money and thereby change the deflation that existed to inflation in order to be able to pay off debts more easily via the ensuing higher prices for the farmers' produce. Now, this was not a new idea. Back in the 1870s, the Greenback Movement had called for keeping in circulation greenbacks, special paper money that the government had printed during the Civil War. In fact, this deflation-inflation thing is still an issue today. There is presently, and always has been, fear of the impact of a deflation. Now, opponents of what was called free silver screamed that this is unsound economics that would lead to disaster via Gresham's law, that bad money drives out good money. They also argued that the financial king at that point, England, would never accept this, nor would the rest of the world, and that it would ruin the economy of the United States. Now, Congress in 1878 and in 1890 had agreed to limited silver purchase in the Bland-Allison Act and the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. But what the populists call for is free and unlimited coinage at the 16-to-1 ratio with more printing of paper money as a result. This would become the populist's most popular plank. But the party's general aim, as stated in its platform, was to get an alliance of all farmers, all labor, all races in all sections of the country. Along with the platform went a revivalist tone of holy war, impending doom, and cataclysmic confrontation. The forces of good versus the forces of evil. This can be seen in the preamble to the platform that I quoted, and in the nicknames of some of the populist leaders. Calamity Weller of Iowa, Sockless Jerry Simpson of Kansas, Bloody Bridles Waite of Colorado, Cyclone Davis of Texas. But the fury of the populace was perhaps best summarized by the statement of one Mary Leese from Kansas, who said that it was time to raise, quote, less corn and more hell. The result was the extraordinary election of 1892. In the Midwest, opponents of the populace pictured them as filthy, illiterate idiots who would wreck the country if they were elected. As Kansas newspaper editor William Allen White would put it a few years later, this is from an 1896 editorial entitled, What's the Matter with Kansas? What is? What White said? We all know, yet here we are at it again. We have an old mossback Jacksonian who snorts and howls because there's a bathtub in the statehouse. We're running that old Jay for governor. We have another shabby, wild-eyed, rattle-brained fanatic who has said openly in a dozen speeches that, quote, the rights of the user are paramount to the rights of the owner. We're running him for chief justice so that capital will come tumbling over itself into this state. Oh, this is a state to be proud of. We are a people who can hold up their heads. What we need is not more money, but less capital. Fewer white shirts and brains, fewer men with business judgment, and more of those fellows who boast that they are, quote, just ordinary clodhoppers, but they know more in a minute about finance than John Sherman. We need more men who are posted, who can bellow about the crime of 73, who hate prosperity, and who think because a man believes in national honor, he is a tool of Wall Street. We've had a few of them, some 150,000, but we need more. In the South, some populists, not all of them, but some populists attempted to unite whites and blacks in a class war against the white conservatives. Tom Watson of Georgia put it this way. You are kept apart that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the arch of financial despotism which enslaves you both. You are deceived and blinded that you may not see how this race antagonism perpetuates a monetary system which beggars both. Watson would nominate a black man to the party's state executive committee in Georgia and would protect that individual's home with armed white populace when racists threatened. Conservative white Democrats and realize that the South at this point is a one-party area. No Republican can be elected within the South. The struggles are all within the Democratic Party, but now the Populist Party is coming forth as an alternative. Conservative white Democrats will respond to Watson by saying that he is threatening anarchy, Negro supremacy, mongrelism, and, quote, the destruction of the Saxon womanhood of our wives and daughters. Merchants will refuse credit to farmers who won't disavow the populace. And there is violence, fraud, and intimidation in both sections of the country, along with some armed state legislatures. By the way, in the South, conservative Democrats now complete the disenfranchisement of blacks out of fear that Watson's rhetoric might work. Now, when the smoke is cleared, the Democrat Grover Cleveland has won the presidential election of 1892. But the populace have scored 1 million votes for president, which translates into 22 electoral votes. They have also elected numerous senators, congressmen, governors, and state legislators. In Grover Cleveland's first year in office, 1893, a massive depression hit. It is the worst one to date. 20% of the workforce is unemployed, and there is no government relief at all. Those who still have jobs face massive salary cuts. The results would include 1,400 strikes in 1894 alone, and violence as government sides once again with business and sends in troops. There is also a rush on the U.S. gold reserve. And that leaves Cleveland to turn to J.P. Morgan to bail out the U.S. Treasury and to have Congress repeal the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. Cleveland does not believe in free silver, and he thinks even the Limited Silver Purchase Act is making things worse. He is dead wrong. And what he does by repealing that act makes the economic situation worse and only increases the popularity of free silver. At the same time, populist Ohio businessman Jacob Coxey organizes the first march on Washington, labeled Coxey's Army, to support his idea of a government public works program for the unemployed to be financed with paper money. He is arrested when he reaches Washington with his marchers forced into detention camps. It is also in 1894 that the Supreme Court will declare the income tax unconstitutional. It all comes to a head in the election of 1896. The Democratic Party repudiates Cleveland as Silverites from the South and the West gain control of the Democratic Convention and place free silver, as well as many other populist proposals, in their proposed platform. That leads to a huge floor fight over whether to accept this. The last individual to speak was a 36-year-old congressman from Nebraska, William Jennings Bryan, who delivered the extraordinary speech known as the Cross of Gold speech, which ended with the following statement. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. Well, that got the platform passed. It also got Bryan nominated for the presidency. Gold Democrats, like Cleveland, thereupon bolted. And this initiated a major party realignment as those in favor of the gold standard moved to the Republican Party and any Republicans in favor of free silver moved to the Democratic Party or the Populist Party for that matter. This also put the populace in a quandary. The Democrats had taken their most popular issue. Obvious solution, fusion with the Democrats. But that means a loss of identity and much of their party platform. Whereas no fusion means that the anti-silver Republican candidate William McKinley will win the election. The populist solution was to agree to nominate Bryan for the presidency in their party. Democrats and the populists nominate Bryan, but to choose their own vice presidential candidate, none other than Tom Watson. The campaign will be one of the most polarized in all of American history. Bryan is portrayed as a wild-eyed radical. Businesses threaten to close if workers vote for him. McKinley's campaign manager, Mark Hanna, capitalizes on this fear to obtain massive contributions from business and brings people to McKinley's home, rather than vice versa. Now, Bryan doesn't have such resources. His major resources were his youth and his extraordinary oratorical ability, though critics argued that he was like the Platte River of his home state, 6 miles wide and 6 inches deep at the mouth. For or against Bryan, he became the first presidential candidate to barnstorm the country, and he made free silver the issue. One historian, Richard Hofstadter, quipped that Bryan was the only presidential candidate to run on the strength of a monomania. The conflict in financial terms appeared to be David versus Goliath. And Goliath won. McKinley won handily. The election was a huge, overwhelming McKinley victory. 271 to 176 in the Electoral College and 7 million popular votes for McKinley to 6.5 million for Bryan. That may not sound like a landslide, but remember, this is the era when presidential elections had often hinged on one state and 10,000 votes. Bryan carried only the South, part of the Great Plains, and the Rocky Mountain silver mining states. McKinley swept the industrial Northeast and the old Midwest. He also took the Granger states, some of the wheat states, and labor and urban areas. These did not vote for Bryan. Labor and urban voters in particular did not want inflation. That might help farmers. It would not help them. And they were personally affronted by the Bryan populist evangelical rhetoric, which they saw as anti-Catholic and anti-urban. Bryan even referred to the Northeast as enemy country. And in the Cross of Gold speech, he countered cries that the cities favored the gold standard by saying, quote, "The great cities rest upon our fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and grass will grow in the streets of every city in the country." That didn't go over too well with working men. Now, many historians, such as Richard Hofstadter, agree with the anti-Bryan voters. And they label the populace as counter-revolutionaries, reactionaries who wished to reject modernity. And that interpretation is reinforced by what happened to populism after its collapse as a third-party movement. Watson turned racist. He saw that the race card was more effective than the class card. The populace also showed streaks of anti-Semitism, anti-Catholicism, conspiracy theories. Bryan became a prohibitionist, and by the 1920s, he was defending a Tennessee law outlawing the theory of evolution. We'll talk more about that in a later lecture. Other historians disagree sharply. Now, what conclusions can we reach from all of this? Although the populace were defeated in the 1890s, some of the measures they called for in the Omaha platform were enacted during the Progressive Era and the New Deal Era. Nevertheless, many of the issues that led to the populist movement lost relevance with the passage of time and with the tremendous decrease in the percentage of our population engaged in farming. Yet the word lives on in both our historical and our political controversies, as does the rhetoric of the populist platform in calls today for action to address the enormous gap between the rich and the poor and the economic plight of many Americans. Historians still debate who and what the populists were and whether they were radical revolutionaries trying to overthrow the existing order or progressive reformers just a few years ahead of their time or reactionaries rejecting modernity and trying to turn the clock back in time or just an agrarian interest group out to get its piece of the pie. Similarly, the public continues to debate what a populist is as the term is used today. Literally, populism means for the people. But which people? And how? And is it forward-looking or backward-looking, hysterical, and dangerous? The answer to that depends on your own politics, as well as your views of whomever you are describing. In the 20th century, the term populist was used to describe political figures on both the left and the right. That included Eugene Debs, Robert La Follette, the progressive, Huey Long of Louisiana, and Senator Joseph McCarthy. 2008, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont on the left was described as a populist, while Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, was also described as a populist. People who are labeled populists are described in both positive terms, such as man or woman of the people, and in negative terms, such as ignorant demagogue, depending upon whether one is at the same end of the political spectrum, the opposite end, or somewhere in the middle. Such descriptions and disagreements echo descriptions and disagreements regarding the populace more than a century ago. Despite what appears to be the lack of relevance to our lives today of the specific problems they faced and their attempted solutions, those descriptions and disagreements over contemporary populace may also determine how one views the original movement and its leaders, and whether one believes or not that problems and their proposed solutions are relevant or irrelevant to our lives today.
Lecture 12, Labor in America, A Strange History.
During the early 21st century, a movement gained traction in this country to rescind the collective bargaining rights of unionized teachers and other state employees. Now, whether in favor or opposed to this action, many Americans perceived it as a dramatic reversal of historic governmental policy towards unions, a governmental policy often described as either pro-union or as trying to be a fair arbiter between business and labor. But in reality, that 21st century effort is a continuation or reassertion of traditional government hostility to labor unions, a hostility that dates back at least to the last third of the 19th century, if not earlier. This lecture will explore the reasons for that hostility and the ensuing governmental actions. It will also explore the responses of American labor during the late 19th century, responses that separated American workers sharply from their European counterparts. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century led to the creation of a new class of largely unskilled industrial workers as traditional artisans were put out of business. Before the Industrial Revolution, a shoemaker would make an entire shoe. He would also own his own shop, set his own hours, and probably live above his own store. Come the Industrial Revolution and the assembly line, which can produce shoes much cheaper than this individual working by hand, and he will be closed down. He cannot compete. He will become an unskilled worker on a shoe assembly line, nailing, for example, heels onto shoes, doing hundreds of them a day, rather than producing the entire shoe. Now, work in these factories was boring, it was repetitive, it was often dangerous, with very long hours and very low pay. The average work week in many factories during the late 19th century was 60 hours. Pay, approximately 20 cents an hour for the few still existing skilled jobs, and 10 cents an hour for unskilled work. Steel workers had 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week for such pay. And in occupations such as mine working, laborers were often paid in company scrip that was redeemable only at the company store. And in all fields, workers would be laid off or suffer pay cuts during the periodic economic depressions that occurred. As a result of all this, more than half of industrial workers did not make enough to support their families. Somewhere between $500 and $600 annually was needed for that. So as noted in a previous lecture, their wives and their children had to work for even lower wages. Contrary to another myth, women made up approximately 20% of the industrial workforce at this time. Workers responded to all of this with efforts to organize into labor unions in order to fight for better pay and better working conditions. Their key weapon was the strike, to force employers to agree to bargain over their demands or face a shutdown of their factories. Now, as noted in a previous lecture, the U.S. government's policy in the late 19th century was not laissez-faire. It was pro-business. And this pro-business policy included hostility toward labor unions that tried to form during this time period, and the use of armed force to suppress numerous union strikes. Partially as a result, effective unionization of industrial workers in this country would take much longer than it did in Europe. It would also lead to a very different union ideology. Well, one obvious question to arise here is, why was there such hostility to labor unions, and why was there such failure to organize during this time period? Numerous reasons. Many industrial workers continued to believe in the traditional American dream and the traditional American ideology of individualism, the belief that they could make it on their own as individuals. Unionization equaled recognition that they no longer could do so. For that very reason, the American middle class also opposed unionization and saw it as an attack on the American dream. That middle class was also alienated by the violence that accompanied many strikes. In addition, this was the era of the so-called new immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe as well as Asia. The older wave of immigration had come from Western and Northern Europe. These new immigrants came from different races, different ethnic groups. They possessed different religions, different languages, and different cultures. Those differences divided American workers, making union solidarity extremely difficult, if not impossible. Compounding this problem, employers often pitted these groups against each other as strikebreakers. For example, if Polish workers struck, the employers might hire Italian workers to replace them, or black workers. Employers also hired private armies, often of Pinkerton detectives, to violently break strikes. Unions also often collapsed under economic pressure during the periodic depressions that racked the country during this time period. In addition, and as previously noted, the courts defined corporations as individuals possessing the same guaranteed rights as citizens. Consequently, the courts voided state laws that attempted to regulate industry as violations of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. The courts also issued injunctions against union strikes on the grounds that they threatened property rights and, in an incredible irony, previously noted, that these strikes constituted a restraint of trade in violation of the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act. And both state and national governments would use armed force to enforce these injunctions and to break strikes. Now, on the state level, again as previously noted, this led to the revival of the largely moribund state militia system through government support of volunteer militia units that came to be known as the National Guard. And on the national level, it would lead to the use of the United States Army against strikers. Now, in a previous lecture, we looked at the railroad strike of 1877 and very briefly at the 1894 Pullman strike to illustrate the government's use of military force against unions as one way the government did not have a laissez-faire attitude towards business. In this lecture, we will take a much closer look at the Pullman strike. We will also examine the 1892 Homestead strike to explore government-labor relations during this time. Let's look first at the 1892 Homestead strike at the Carnegie Steel plant in Homestead, Pennsylvania. That plant employed 3,000 unskilled workers. They were paid 14 cents per hour for a 10-hour day, 6 to 7 days a week. There were also 800 skilled and unionized workers at the plant. They did much better. They were getting paid anywhere from $50 to $70 a week, but only when the mill was on full production. Only 40% of steel workers worked a full year. The average was 32 weeks per year. The factories would close when demand was not sufficient to keep them open. In 1889, Carnegie appointed Henry Frick, who already had a reputation as a union buster, to manage the Homestead plant. And he instructed Frick to sign no new union contract with the skilled workers when the old one expired in June 1892. Instead, Homestead was to overproduce steel before that date in order to create a surplus and then close the plant in what was called a lockout. Keep the workers out, and that was designed to break the union. The union responded to this by calling upon all Homestead workers, skilled and unskilled, to strike, which they did. They also took over Homestead, which was a company town. Frick responded by hiring strikebreakers and 300 Pinkerton detectives. On July 6th, workers opened fire on those detectives and burned their barges. 7 Pinkertons and 9 workers died. Sympathy strikes soon spread to other Carnegie steel mills. On July 12th, the governor of Pennsylvania sent in 7,000 state militia. And on July 18th, 7 strike leaders were arrested and charged with murder. Then on July 23rd, an anarchist, Alexander Berkman, attempted to assassinate Frick. He failed. On August 30th, the strike committee was arrested on conspiracy charges, and some were denied bail. 185 separate indictments were issued. By October, 1,600 Carnegie workers were on the relief rolls, and in November, the union gave up. Of the 3,800 total workers at Homestead, only 800 were ever rehired. And in retrospect, this failure spelled the end of any unionization in the steel industry for 40 years. Let's now turn to the 1894 Pullman sleeping car strike. This took place originally in the supposedly model company town of Pullman, Illinois. Pullman plant workers declared a strike after 5 wage cuts in the year, totaling anywhere from 25 to 40% of their wages. Those wage cuts were due to the Depression of 1893. But while you had these 5 wage cuts, there was no reduction in company rent. When the workers struck, Pullman responded by closing the plant. No violence took place at this time. Now, on appeal by the striking plant workers, the Independent American Railway Union, under Eugene Victor Debs, voted to aid the strikers by nationally boycotting Pullman cars. They simply would not deal with Pullman cars. The railroads began to fire union members who did boycott Pullman cars. Debs then called upon his union, 150,000 members strong, to walk off the job. That crippled the entire national rail system. The governor of Illinois, John Altgeld, was sympathetic to the union. He refused to send in state troops, at which point the railroad owners went to President Grover Cleveland, whose attorney general, Richard Olney, sent in 3,400 special deputies over the protests of Governor Altgeld. The grounds? The need to keep the trains running for the mail and the fact that the federal government was responsible for interstate commerce. That move led to violence. And Debs was jailed for violating a federal court injunction that had prohibited the strike on the grounds that it was, quote, a combination in restraint of trade that violated the Sherman Antitrust Act. When Debs emerged from jail, he announced that he was now a socialist. And soon thereafter, the Socialist Party of America would be formed with Debs as its standard bearer. Debs would run for president of the United States 5 times as the candidate of the Socialist Party. In 1912, he would poll nearly 1 million votes. But that was as close as socialism ever came to being accepted in the United States, and it really wasn't close at all. The situation in Europe was quite different. Indeed, in most European countries, socialist political parties were forming with union members as their backbone. They demanded not merely better working conditions and wages, but an end to the entire capitalist system via a government takeover of the factories. Now, many of these socialist parties would emerge as the largest parties within their countries. And in an extraordinary irony, the highly conservative and class-conscious German aristocrat and political leader, Otto von Bismarck, would make Germany the first country to institute social security. He did this as a means of co-opting and weakening the very large Social Democratic Party, a party that he hated. This is a good time to explain some very important distinctions within the socialist movement. First of all, European socialist parties were not communist. In fact, communist parties did not even exist until the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the fragmentation of the international socialist movement during World War I. Both Debs's Socialist Party of America and the large socialist parties of Europe were democratic, and they believed in achieving socialism via the ballot box. They were thus named Social Democrats or Democratic Socialists. Communists, on the other hand, believed in the violent overthrow of capitalism and the establishment of what Karl Marx had called, quote, the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is what occurred in Russia. In point of fact, socialism as a whole is an economic system, whereas communism is a dictatorial political system. Now, contrary to common belief, many Americans in the late 19th century and the early 20th century were attracted to socialism. The American middle class would be introduced to socialist ideas through Edward Bellamy's very popular 1888 novel, Looking Backward, and the ensuing formation of Bellamy clubs throughout the country. And by 1912, while Debs was polling a million votes for president, 450 socialists had been elected to office. That included more than 50 mayors and one congressman. But this was not Marxian socialism as it developed in Europe. Bellamy, for example, placed much more emphasis on nationalism and on a peaceful shift in the United States from capitalism to socialism. He did this through a Rip Van Winkle-type character who began the book in a very violent, strike-filled, violence-filled America, only to wake up to find that this violent capitalist world had been peacefully transformed into a utopian socialist world, as people simply voted to have the government take over the factories. Now, despite the popularity of Bellamy's novel and the limited success of the Socialist Party of America, socialist ideology nevertheless had far less appeal in the United States than it did in Europe. In fact, the United States never developed the large social democratic parties that many European nations did. And indeed, those social democratic parties in the 20th century would govern many of these European countries, including England after World War II under the Labour Party. Why did the United States not develop such a party and such a movement is a question that numerous historians have long asked. Well, there are numerous reasons. One major reason was that Americans as a whole did not possess the class consciousness that Europeans did from their very lengthy history, dating back at least to the Middle Ages, a history of very distinct classes. You had aristocrats, you had a middle class, you had peasants. Americans lacked that history. And the Europeans who came here to a large extent to escape that history. And without that history, you would not have the class consciousness that accompanied it. Indeed, Marxism and many other varieties of socialism were viewed by many in the United States as European and un-American. In this environment, only one national labor union succeeded during this time period. And it did so largely by eschewing any anti-capitalist political goals. I am talking about the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, under its longtime leader, Samuel Gompers. Under Gompers' leadership, the AFL refused to have anything to do with socialist ideas, socialist political parties, and anti-capitalist radicalism, whether it was democratic or undemocratic. Plain and simple trade unionism was Gompers' motto. And he emphasized the fact that the AFL's only aim was to improve the wages, the hours, and the working conditions of union members within a capitalist system. Furthermore, and unlike other national unions of this era, such as the Knights of Labor welcomed all. The AFL limited its membership to skilled male white workers. That was an elite group constituting only 5% of the total workforce. And that elite group was organized in the AFL along craft lines rather than factory lines. All cigar makers, like Gompers, would be in the cigar makers' union. The alternative in heavy industry was to place all workers, whether they made cigars or anything else, into the same union. Now, Gompers was willing to use the strike and the boycott. He was also willing to back specific candidates from existing political parties, but only to obtain his limited goals of higher wages, shorter hours, relief from technological unemployment, and pro-labor legislation. In effect, he was willing to use what were perceived in the late 19th century as radical means, but only for limited conservative ends. Gompers and the AFL made clear in this regard that they did not want to overthrow the capitalist system. They just wanted to get their piece of the pie. Indeed, Gompers favored mediation and arbitration of labor disputes rather than strikes when he ran into businessmen who were willing to deal with him and his union. And there were many big businessmen who were willing to do so, on the grounds that Gompers and the AFL were far better than the radicals. These businessmen also figured out that they could afford to give higher wages and shorter hours that Gompers demanded. Small businessmen, on the other hand, often could not, and they therefore continued to oppose labor unions. Now, big businessmen were not the only individuals to see this. Socialists saw it as well. And they opposed the AFL, founding in 1905 their own radical industrial union, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, or Wobblies. And that union was founded with the ringing declaration that, quote, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. In direct opposition to the AFL, the IWW sought to organize all workers, unskilled as well as skilled, along industrial, that is, factory lines, rather than along craft lines, and to amass sufficient members and power so as to eventually be able to overthrow the entire capitalist system. The IWW never achieved the popularity, strength, and acceptance of the AFL, and both before and during World War I, it was decimated by government repression. Now, Gompers and the AFL have been accurately described as, quote, a new generation's capitulation to the corporate revolution. In effect, they constituted a corporation of labor, organized in a corporate manner to obtain profits for their members within a capitalist system. Operating in this manner, Gompers was able to obtain, in the 1914 Clayton Antitrust Act, a clear statement that labor was, quote, not a commodity or article of commerce, and that it had a right to organize and use peaceful strikes, picketing, and boycotts, and not to be considered a combination in restraint of trade. The Clayton Act also placed restrictions on the use of court injunctions against organized labor. Furthermore, the AFL would become the model for later successful unions in this country, most notably the Congress of Industrial Organizations, better known as the CIO. The CIO first developed within the AFL, but then broke away to organize unskilled factory workers in the 1930s. Now, the CIO was willing to use more radical means than the AFL. In particular, rather than striking outside the factory, CIO workers would sit down inside the factory, thereby closing down the factory, making it impossible for employers to hire strikebreakers. But the CIO similarly accepted the capitalist system, and like the AFL, simply asked for its piece of the pie as well. Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal, as we will see, broke with traditional governmental policy in the 1930s by supporting this effort and supporting unionization in general, most notably with the 1935 Wagner Labor Relations Act. And in effect, the CIO, this new and powerful corporate union, along with the AFL, replaced through the activities of its members and its financial donations the many corporate businesses that broke with Roosevelt and the Democratic Party in the 30s over this and over the entire New Deal. But the New Deal's break with past governmental policy should not be overstated. Indeed, during and after World War II, Roosevelt and his successor Harry Truman proved more than willing to move against union strikes, especially in the coal and steel industries, when those strikes were perceived as endangering the national welfare. Furthermore, a Republican Congress would in 1947 pass the Taft-Hartley Act over Truman's veto, and that act placed sharp limits on labor union activities, including strikes. Now, despite his veto of the bill, which was overridden, Truman would wind up using the act on numerous occasions. So would his successors. And in 1981, President Ronald Reagan would fire striking air traffic controllers who had refused to obey his order to end this illegal strike and return to work. Union membership as a percentage of the workforce also declined in the last third of the 20th century, as the economic base of the United States moved away from heavy industry, and with that came a decline in union power. Now, unionization of such white-collar professions as teachers and government workers did take place, but with uneven success and with numbers and power that could not and did not make up for these losses by industrial unions. Whether total union power is now so reduced as to lead to an end to collective bargaining rights for at least some unions remains unclear and to be seen. What is clear is that what is occurring in the 21st century is far from an aberration and a break with past history. Indeed, the real aberration is the pro-union policies of the New Deal during the 1930s. That this aberration has come to be viewed incorrectly as what has always existed speaks volumes about the way in which an event in the relatively recent past can distort our perceptions about our entire past, and with it, our perceptions about the present.
Lecture 13, Myths About American Isolation and Empire.
In 1898,